Coming up next on This Week in Radio Tech, we're talking to a politician. That's right. The mayor of Verona, New Jersey, Alex Roman, also happens to be the chief technical officer at two of the biggest radio stations in the number one market, New York City. Alex is coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by Max Connect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb at the top of the tower there. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host in the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Today, getting close to Christmas time, we just have one more show before Christmas, and then one more show after Christmas, and then it'll be next year. Got some cool announcements coming up for you. It's been a year that I've been hosting the show by myself without Chris Tobin being here, because Chris passed away just about 1 year ago. In fact, about 1 year ago today, or I think tomorrow was the date. So we are going to probably have a show where we talk a bit about Chris Tobin, bring in a special guest, one of Chris's good friends. That'll be coming up in the next couple of weeks. So, all right, I'm looking forward to that. And then we have an announcement about a new co-host for 2022. So hope you'll stick around for that too. All right. A little programming note today. Suncast, our usual producer, is unavailable because the power is out at the big GFQ Network studios where Suncast is ensconced. And so I am producing the show myself today. We're going to have to see how well this works or how well it doesn't work. I'm wondering if you'll ever have me back as the show producer. It's a good possibility that you won't. So let's just do the best we can. I want to bring in our guest. Our guest today is Alex Roman. Alex from New York City, right? You're in New York?
I am in New York City.
Great. Good to see you. Wow. I wish I had some fanfare and applause. I've been wanting to have you on the show literally for years. I've been doing the show for, what, about 12 years now, and you've been in New York City for, what, almost 17, 18 years now?
18 years at this point. It's been a while.
So. Wow. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. Folks who don't know Alex Roman, you have a very interesting resume. Tell us about yourself.
Thank you. So originally from California, started doing this right out of high school. This is I've always been in computers and technology, and ended up working for a station cluster in Sacramento, California. It was the my first stop, and it's turned into a career since there. Made passes through Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, and then on to New York. As you mentioned, 18 years here in New York. I'm starting to call it home at this point. I keep joking about it that I'm a temporary New Yorker, and no one believes me anymore. So I guess I have to call it home. And my side gig, obviously, that is interesting. I'm the mayor of the township of Verona, New Jersey.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I got to hear a little bit about this. In fact, I want to hear a little bit about it now, and maybe we can get into it a little bit deeper later on in the show. You know, I probably in my whole life have maybe known two mayors of different towns, small towns. One guy was the mayor. He was also my physician. Okay. My primary care physician, Berea, Kentucky, small town. Oh, the guy was crazy. He was also not a flight surgeon, but he was one of those doctors that could approve you for your FAA medical.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So, but I've never known a mayor who was also a broadcast engineer. Yeah. This seems a little crazy to me and really good. Engineers have minds that I tend to agree with how they think, maybe not always politically, but at least, you know, there's a process in the thinking. Tell me what motivated you to run for mayor.
So I was watching the way my town was run, and I felt like I could help do a little bit better. And I've always said that when you see something that's got a problem, you can do one of two things. You can say somebody must do something, or you can say I must do something. So I said, I will run. I hopefully can help this place a little bit. There were some organizational challenges, and I thought I saw a way through them. So went around town, started knocking on doors, good old fashioned retail politics in a small town, got to know everybody there. I lost the first time I ran. But if you fail, try again. I ran a second time, and I won by a pretty decent margin, which was great. And for 6 years, I've been sitting on this city council, and I just got made the mayor of the town in July of this year. So something I never in a million years thought I'd end up doing, but here I am.
What was your campaign slogan? What was your promise?
Efficient, effective, open. Just things that I saw in government where we didn't ever ask the question, well, why do we do it this way? You know, can you really look at this in a vacuum and say this is the best that we can do with this? And just a lot of new thinking, and a lot of it centered around tech, and believe it or not, even radio systems too.
Wait a minute. Everything you just said in the last three or four sentences sounds like you're a forward-looking broadcast engineer, and yet you were saying this as your promise in being a mayor.
Yeah, absolutely. I said, I think through things. This is what I do. I fix things. And they actually, like I said, they had a lot of technology challenges in particular. And I felt like I could step in and offer that perspective. And that's really what these small towns are all about. It's people with a different perspective in outside life. None of us are full-time politicians. We all have a day job. But we've had people that are building service engineers that maintain buildings. We've had people that are attorneys. We've had all types of people that come in and bring their experience and have a voice in things. So it's been a very interesting adventure the last couple of years.
So Verona, New Jersey, right?
Verona, New Jersey, population. I think we're going to be about 14,000 in this census data.
Now, I live in Tennessee. I've lived in Kentucky and in Texas. We don't have townships in these states. What's a township?
A township is a creation from a number of years ago that had to do with getting certain types of federal funding. So for a long time, we were actually the township of the borough of Verona, because we used to be the borough of Verona, and they changed forms of government in order to take advantage of some of those rules. There are 9 different ways of setting up a town in the state of New Jersey, because we have towns that are as small as a population of 9, believe it or not, up to towns that are hundreds of thousands. So they all have different forms of government as to what you do. There are some towns where you get elected essentially the sanitation commissioner or the police commissioner, as opposed to just being a council member at large. There are towns where you get directly elected as the mayor. In my town, the council picks the mayor out of the group of us. So there's a lot of different ways to run things in New Jersey. It's all very interesting, and it's been a whole different set of things I've had to learn about. I just went to our version of NAB a couple of weeks ago. I went to the New Jersey League of Municipalities convention.
Obviously, it's not a full-time job, because there you sit in New York City at some radio stations.
Absolutely. It's certainly not a full-time job, although sometimes it tries to be one. My full-time job, I run Hot 97 and WBLS for media co-holding in New York. I just crossed the 10-year mark at this set of radio stations. 2 major Class Bs on the Empire State Building, stations with a long legacy, a lot of history behind them, and just been a great place to work that I've really enjoyed.
Now, obviously, I've been out of the loop a little bit, because you said media co-holding, right? And last I knew, those were Emmis radio stations. What changed?
We did get spun from Emmis. We were held by Emmis for an extraordinarily long time. They still own a piece of us. But it was it just went into a new company that we started up. And these are the only 2 radio stations that are in this company right now. It does have interests in outdoor media as well. But it's interesting being a small part of a large part of a growing company is an interesting changeover. It gives you a lot of opportunities, again, to kind of set things out from the ground up and look at how you do things. So it's been actually a good experience getting this started up and built.
One of your stations you mentioned is Hot 97.1, right?
Right, that is.
What are those call letters there?
WQHT.
QHT, that's right. Okay. Yep. And seems I recall that Hot 97.1 is sometimes, maybe frequently, the number one rated station. Is it close?
In its target demo cell, it's usually number one or number two, and it does pretty well all over. BLS is actually tends to hover around the top of the charts as well. BLS did hit number one 12 plus not long ago. It's just kind of a constant battle for the top in tenths of a share point. But both these stations, like I said, just monsters in their demographics. They really do very well. They have a long legacy behind them. The programming's fantastic. So really do enjoy working here.
I recall when I used to come to New York more regularly to sell audio processing, would always listen to 97.1 and think, man, that station is loud and it sounds so good. And I was just always amazed.
Hopefully you still think that if you come in and listen to it again. So,
yeah, we're going to be talking to Alex about a number of topics. I want to understand, more about what it's like with the pressures of, market number one, New York City. How does that affect the way you live, work, think, backup systems, things like that? But I'm more interested in where we want to go with our conversation about some innovative ways that you're handling content creation now, you know, the tools that you provide to the staff, because I think that that's a big part of your career there, is providing them the reliable tools that look good, sound good, I think I just gave away, it away, you know, because you guys are doing video, and that's going to be interesting. So, Alex, we're going to take a quick break and tell our friends about a couple of our sponsors. And let me hit the button here. There we go. One of our sponsors is Angry Audio, and you know, they bought the entire Studio Hub line. That means they have these things that I love, because you can build radio stations so easily with these adapters. You know, so many products, so many pieces of equipment these days, especially if it's audio over IP equipment like Axia X-Nodes or the Wheatstone blades. Then there's audio consoles that also use RJ45 connectors as their audio ins and outs, not for Ethernet, but for balanced left and right audio, or for AES/EBU digital audio. And these adapters will get you from legacy gear into the kind of connectors that you want. They're easy to use. Yeah, people think, yo, I can just solder that up. Yes, you can. You can. And you don't want to. And as far as making this end of it, oh my goodness, it takes a whole technology, a whole years of actually developing tooling to take stranded audio wire and properly get it crimped into an RJ45 that's going to be reliable. So you can get these in the female XLR. There's another female XLR. You can get them in a singleton like this. This is for AES/EBU audio. So this would be into a male. This will get you from AES/EBU or out of a node or a blade into an AES/EBU input. And then, of course, there's much longer ones as well. Here's one I got it wrapped up. It's about a 6-foot one. And this will go, you know, from the back of a piece of gear, audio out into audio in somewhere. All this is from Studio Hub, and Studio Hub is owned by Angry Audio. So you can go to angryaudio.com, check out their website, and see the whole catalog. A couple other things that Angry Audio has continued from Studio Hub, the best of it here. Here is an IHF to pro level converter. So this goes from your unbalanced RCA connectors at minus 10, comes out here at plus 4 balanced. So this will go right into your node, your blade, whatever. And it's powered also through the Studio Hub power scheme right here on that RJ45 connector. Then here's another useful thing. This is an analog to digital converter. So if you want to come out of a device as analog, and you can come out as, again, IHF, that's the minus 10, semi-pro, or you can come out as balanced stereo in, or going into this, and you'll come out of this as AES/EBU digital audio right here in the digital output. So lots of different converters. Check it out. Go to angryaudio.com. Their website is amazing. You'll find then all the Angry Audio gear, like the Bluetooth gadget. You'll find headphone amplifiers. You'll find devices to take a inexpensive console, like a cheap Behringer console, and make it into more of a broadcast console with muting and mic muting and speaker muting and all that kind of stuff. AngryAudio.com. Hey, we got to hear from one more place, and that is our friends at Max Connect Wireless. Alex and I will be right back in just a minute.
I'm Gary Morrill, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
Thanks, Gary. And I've got one of them right here, Max Connect. And you know, when we are out in the field or on the road, we do contribute to This Week in Radio Tech using Max Connect Wireless. When we can't get a wired connection, we use this, and it does work. Hey, there's been all kinds of remote broadcasts done this way. And getting IP to a transmitter side using MaxConnect Wireless is the reliable way to get it done. These 4G LTE modems have external antenna connections. So even if you need to put an outdoor connection, an outdoor antenna that's directional on these, you can do that. Plus, they have diversity antennas on them. This one happens to be from PepWave, but they also have these 4G LTE modems from Cradlepoint as well. But it's not the modem that makes the difference. It's the SIM card inside from MaxConnect Wireless. Go to maxconnect.com. It's spelled funny. We'll have the link in the show notes. Thanks for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks to Josh Bone and MaxConnect Wireless. All right, it's Kirk Harnack here, our 574th episode, just a couple of shows before Christmas. Alex Roman is my guest today. And Alex, we're going to talk about some of the technologies that are really helping you guys out. You try a lot of stuff. Talk to me about some of the things that have been, you know, most helpful to you during the pandemic and how it's helped you to continue to produce great radio shows in market number one.
Well, so as soon as we heard that we were going to have to go home, we were, you know, scrambling like everybody, figuring out how long this was going to be for, what we were going to do. And one of the things that's very unique about this set of radio stations is that we are very heavy on live content. We are live almost around the clock. We have a large air staff on both stations. So we don't really voice track historically a lot, though we can. We've just had people in the studio all the time, and we needed immediately to undo that. So first thing I did, obviously, bought a couple of Comrex Connects and sent those out to everybody. They've been using those ever since. They've been very, very successful. I can just hand these things to a jock and they can just go out in the field with them and use them on their own personal Wi-Fi generally. We try and encourage them again to plug in at least at home. But we've been doing shows from that. My morning show is split up and been in four different locations. We've used Clean Feed very heavily also for places where we don't want to deploy a codec. We've used that for contribution. We've used everything that was in our pile of studio codecs that we had left over. We have some Zip ones that went out in the field. We had some Comrex bricks. We basically scrounged through everything, every single shelf we could find here for anything that had an audio input and a network output and handed it to somebody. So we have pretty effectively turned this place into a remote operation, but then we still wanted to do the rich content that we started, that we've always been doing. This place has been very, very successful with video. We try and take everything that we produce and put it into some form of video. So we've still been capturing on top of that. We've been using StreamYard as a platform for one of our choices while we've been out in the field, split across multiple sites, and trying to maintain that same level of production quality that we always have had on the radio. And then we started to get people back in the building, and it's still worked pretty well, where we couldn't get everybody back in all at the same time. We'd have someone in, but a couple of people out in the field. And we found how important maintaining low latency really was to keep conversations flowing. So there's so much just great product on the market that really worked well. And out of necessity, we just had to start to change our operational model, and it worked well for us.
I'm curious about this using of video. I haven't gone to the website. I haven't looked at the video that you're streaming. If I want to go take a look at that, what's the best way for me to see what you guys think it makes for, I guess, good television or good streaming video?
If you go to YouTube and look at the Hot 97 channel, particularly, we have a very deep archive of a lot of what we've done. Some of it is simply replicating content that was in that happened in the studio, clips from shows. There's a lot of it that is specifically produced for standalone purposes. We've run various forms of episodic programming. We've always had a lot of events. We've simulcast a lot of events and live streamed. We've had specialty live streams within the studios, all done as web video.
When you're out on location and doing some video streaming from location, do you typically just bring one camera, or do you have several cameras?
It really depends on what the production is. We do full remote multi-camera productions from outside facilities and just load up everything in a van, go drive over there and set it all up. I mean, it's become relatively easy these days to accomplish it. Just, a lot of cases of gear, but it's really not that hard to get video back from anywhere as long as you can get a good solid IP link. And we just find that most businesses these days have at least a cable modem that's good enough. We always try and get a little better if we can, but we've been able to get video out of a lot of different venues pretty easily.
I was just kind of thinking romantically about the days of the Marty transmitter and the antenna on the top of the van roof. I guess that's not much of a thing anymore, is it?
So I tell that story to one of the guys that works for me because I put myself in the category of old radio engineer at this point in time, because that was my first job in radio, was to drive the van out to the car dealership on Sunday, put up the Marty mast with the 2.7 segment Yagis on it, and transmit the remote. And you know what? It was kind of fun at that time. Some days I've kind of missed getting a chance to mess around with that kind of radio gear. But, you know, nowadays, like I said, I just hand somebody a Comrex and there you go.
I was just thinking back to you. I mentioned the Yagi antenna. You mentioned the dual Yagi antennas, right?
All that.
And I was just thinking about, I've worked in radio in towns that were so small that the Marty with a transmitting whip antenna was just fine. You did.
we had some vehicles that had 100-watt amps in them to go with it. One of my stations, we had traffic aircraft that were set up as mobile auto relays. It was, we did a lot of work within that with UHF systems, but all of that you just don't really do anymore unless you're doing aerial traffic these days. All that's out the window. So in
trying to get bandwidth at the places that you need to go to, what are some of the typical ways that you'll arrange for internet connections? And, you know, what's your plan A, your plan B? And, oh, gosh, hope you don't have to do plan C, but it does work sometimes. What are your plans there?
So first off, we see what we have to work with. Like I said, a lot of businesses, you really can't get slow cable modems. I mean, most people just don't have DSL anymore. They have either Fios, which has a very heavy deployment here in Manhattan, or they have cable modems. I mean, we're an incredibly dense city, so service availability is very rarely a problem, and it's usually something that's pretty stable and pretty good. All of the wiring in Manhattan is all underground. So it tends to be a pretty good system. So anyone that has a cable modem, generally, we figure we can work off of that to get web video out. There are times where we've had to install our own if we're going to be doing a repeated setup at one particular venue. We have used cradle points in the past with multiple 4G modems. We're starting to get 5G devices. Generally, we do try and stick with hardwire wherever we can. We were using LiveU backpacks a number of years ago, outside service providers. So pretty much anything and everything that works, we're incredibly adaptive here. Whatever works and whatever's efficient and that we can get our hands on, we do it. And then whenever that's just not the way anymore, we just move on to something else.
A business may tell you, hey, we have a service that's 200 down and 50 up or whatever. Do you, or do any of your engineering staff, do you have like minimums that are going to be acceptable to you? And how do you go test for those minimums beforehand?
I mean, we try and go during the event, because one of the things that we during the time of the event at another night. So if we're going to be there on a Friday night, we want to go there on a Friday night, and we'll just use a laptop with speed test and see what's going on. Like places that have free customer Wi-Fi, if it's a nightclub or something like that, or a restaurant that might fill up with people, they can load that down. We've run into issues like that before, and we want to see what the situation is before we get there. We don't really have a hard and fast minimum bandwidth number. We've actually in the past set up fixed wireless shots to get bandwidth from somewhere else to somewhere else. We've had vendors do that. Pretty much anything that we need to do to get connectivity, but it's relatively low cost these days to do this. I mean, worst comes to worst, I just call up and get a cable modem put in. It's not really a problem.
And that happens fast enough to where it's effective for you?
Yeah, you can turn it around relatively quickly. It really is not much of an issue.
I remember days of ISDN when it could be 6 or 8 weeks, depending on where you were. If you're in Hollywood, it could be the next day. But
I remember pleading with the phone company as well. You know, I actually was just begging for 2 POTS lines at one site once. I said I could make do with that. They came out someday and put them in. The 4G network here is incredibly dense. Mm. All the sites are very low to the ground. They're on building rooftops. They're on corners of building, almost at first floor or second floor level. There's DASs in buildings. You can find something. I mean, there's already even service in the subways. We haven't really experimented with trying to see whether or not we can stream out of the subways, but you'll be in a subway station, you'll have 4G LTE, 5 bars.
Yes. I've and you see the little antennas dropping down from the ceiling.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
good deal. In the show here, we're going to end up talking about migrating some of your systems to cloud, but not all of them. You got some concerns about, you know, keeping it a hybrid system, so you have control of maybe the key things, the most important things. We'll talk about next generation systems. I'll tell you what, we're going to have to take a break in 2 or 3 more minutes, but let's talk about tools for internal management. We talked about this in our pre-show meeting, and I wasn't quite sure what you meant. What kind of tools are you talking about that help you manage your workflow internally?
So I look at our department as exactly that, a department of people that work together as a team on projects and systems. We have to share information. We have to be organized. We have to have a plan. So we use tools like, obviously, a trouble ticketing system is key. And we use that for everything, whether it be broadcast or IT. We use things like IP address and data center infrastructure management tools to keep track of our network environment. Again, we have so many devices on the network. We use Microsoft Teams as an environment for internal collaboration, communication, lets us maintain a chat log history, and as well as wiki devices and wiki programs and files. We used to run a separate wiki server at one point in time for documentation. We use SharePoint for a lot of things. So we have this entire tool set and an organizational system amongst our department. So if we need to figure out how something was built, we generally know where the documentation is and can go back and look at it rather than trace wires on something that we built ourselves, but we're coming back to after a number of years, or that something that the other guy in the department might have built, but he's on vacation. So I've always just considered that very important, is to build your own suite up and to test a number of different products out. And generally, they come from the IT world. If you look at systems administration and network administration, outside of broadcast, there are a million different things to monitor. We've always talked about SNMP. You can use monitoring tools that are SNMP from the networking world, like PRTG or other equivalents to that, and monitor broadcast devices or servers you're using for broadcast. So when you look outside of our industry, these tools are very adaptable and very helpful to an engineering department operating.
Speaking of tools, what I've mentioned earlier in the show, let me get back to the two shot here. I need to get an Elgato or something so I can just hit a button. Our producer Suncast is without power this afternoon, and so I'm producing the show myself using StreamYard. I use it occasionally. And one thing that we can do with this, and Alex, this is the very first time I've ever done it on this show, is that I can take viewer comments from Facebook, because we are streaming live to Facebook right now. Now, after the show is done, we top and tail the show, we correct any mistakes in it, and publish it out on YouTube, and that tends to be where it tends to live. But we've got, you know, a few people watching on Facebook right now, and I can take a comment that from earlier in the show. This is my friend Mad Dog. Mad Dog used to, he was a disc jockey in Nashville, Tennessee, many years ago, and He wouldn't want me to say that many years ago. And he says, good day. So, hey, Mad Dog, thanks a lot for checking in. And that's just, I show that to say, hey, you other folks who are watching on Facebook, I think you got to click something, do something, approve yourself to do this. But anyway, you can send a comment along to us. And maybe if you have a question toward the end of the show, we'll do a little Q&A with Alex. Alex Roman is my guest. Not only is he the director, the CTO, right? The Chief Technology Officer over at MediaCo New York Radio in New York City. That's Hot 97 and WBLS, R&B station, WBLS. He's also the mayor of Verona, New Jersey. And so that's a really cool thing. We're going to hear from a couple sponsors here, and we're going to be right back in just a minute. Our friends at Innovonics are one of our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Gary Lerman. I'm Sales and Marketing Manager from Innovonics. I'm joined here by our President and CEO, Ben Barber. And we're here to tell you about two new products that we're very excited about. They're HD modulation monitors, the model 551 and 552. And Ben's going to take us through some of the features. Ben, what can you tell us about these?
The 551 has the big display, 7-inch touchscreen display. You can look at different parameters instantly by walking up to it and touching it, getting information that you need. It also has the LED displays for FM total modulation, left, right, FM, HD 1, 2, 3, and 4. The other thing that the 551 has is that it has full-time audio outputs on studio hub connectors on the back, both analog as well as AES digital. So you've got FM, HD 1 through 4 there full-time. The 552 doesn't have the display, doesn't have the metering, and doesn't have the full-time audio outputs, but the web interfaces are identical for remote viewing and monitoring.
Great. Thanks very much, Ben. These products are going to be available in January 2022. Contact us at InnovonicsBroadcast.com for more information. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot to not only Inovonix, but also to Broadcasters General Store at bgs.cc. That's where you can buy not only anything from Inovonix, but just about anything you need for your broadcast facility. And they even have tools for video production as well, lighting and cameras, wireless mics, all kinds of things like that at Broadcasters General Store. Go to bgs.cc. bgs.cc. Talk to any of them there. Talk to Dave Kirsten. Talk to Carrie, Candy. Talk to Carly, Buck, Hugh, John. They're all there and really friendly people. And I mean that. Thanks a lot to Broadcast General Store for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right. Our guest on the show is Alex Roman. Alex, Chief Technical Officer at a couple of big New York radio stations and Mayor of Verona, New Jersey. So, you told me, Alex, that you would never build a radio station like you did 5 years ago. Now, that's a compelling statement for sure. But what does that mean?
Well, first off, I do have to look at the Facebook comments and say hi to Tim Braddock. So glad you're here, Tim. It's interesting. As I crossed my 10th year in this facility, I started looking back at things that we built while I was here and looking at them and going, yeah, that was great for its time. But would I do it exactly like that again? No. One of the things I've been really big about with facilities is I try and standardize them. I'm not afraid to rebuild them, particularly the infrastructure while it's in place. I'm big on plant installation standards and having everything sort of done the same way within a facility. But once you look, you start to go, okay, well, that actually became obsolete between the time that I put it in and now. And I'm starting to look at things mostly in terms of reducing hardware count. What are discrete devices that I don't want anymore? I used to say you would never sell me a piece of equipment without an Ethernet jack on it again. And now I keep saying you're not going to sell me a piece of equipment that just has an Ethernet jack on it, nothing else on it. You know, that's really sort of the change in mindset is going towards containerization, virtualization. We've gotten really good at building, you know, virtualization hosts and clusters in-house, building network infrastructure out in-house, building out software platforms, and making everything talk to each other so that we're just passing data from VM to VM rather than going out from VM to dedicated hardware box back to network, back to other hardware box when we don't need to. And that's really sort of the when I say I won't do it that way again, nowadays, I'm really going to be looking for software tools, software appliances, containerized applications that can do what hardware used to do.
So one of the topics I'm a little curious about, because you do have a lot of experience with both VMs, virtual machines, and you're getting experience with containerized software. And I'm getting ready to do a webinar on the topic of containerized software for my employer, TELUS Alliance. I'm curious, you know, I think a lot of us engineers, we can figure out a virtual machine and how to do that. And we can figure out even this new topic of containerized software. I'm a little shaky myself on how to figure out how to manage these things or how to keep them from crashing or keep them up to date or know what needs to be. I guess there's a bit of a realm, a layer that I'm a little bit blind to. And maybe you know what I'm talking about. And if you could address that, how do you learn? Yeah, you can watch a YouTube video on how to make a VM but how do you manage this stuff and how do you manage it in a radio station where 24/7 is pretty important? What have you learned? What can you share with us about that topic?
So our operation here is a merged IT and broadcast engineering department. The same group of people work on that same infrastructure. And what we really learned is that broadcast IT is IT. You want to use all of the tools from the enterprise IT world to manage your broadcast IT environment. Your broadcast IT environment should be built to the same standards and same practices as your business IT environment and managed by the same products. And that way, all of your alarm monitoring, your update management, any security tools that you have apply to all of these systems. And as you start installing things, if you have automated deployment systems, for example, you can use those to deploy VMs. And then you can look at what's checking into your patch management servers. So because all these tools exist for us already in the business IT environment, we really do need to take advantage of them for broadcast to make sure that we stay up to date, because we've seen so many stations, unfortunately, that I've seen the hard part of not really updating and security managing all this broadcast infrastructure, and we always want to try and avoid that.
Wow. Okay. So you have an IT staff there, and you said that business IT and broadcast IT should be the same thing, right?
Right.
So the standards that are already well established in business IT, we need to apply those as much as humanly possible to, we don't need to reinvent any wheels over here.
Right. So for example, we have automated build infrastructure for desktop computers, laptop computers. Oh. We do not sit there installing Windows and installing software packages on a computer. We kick off a build, specify, you know, what build group it goes into as to what application set it gets. Hmm. So do that for your broadcast packages as well. A computer is a computer. Running Windows 10 is running Windows 10. So all you have to do is just simply add on a little bit to some of these tools that if you're in a larger operation or if you've simply implemented these things, you probably already have them in your IT environment. If you don't, they're relatively easy to set up even for a small to mid-sized enterprise. And that really helps enforce standardization and best practices. Like I said, that centralized management of antivirus updates, you know, build procedures and processes so that you really don't have things that leak or are otherwise unpatched or not compliant with the standards you've established that are keeping your security together.
While we're on that topic of IT and standardized builds, and I've seen other people do that. I haven't learned how to do that myself. And well, maybe that's not my job. Maybe I'm maybe an IT person really should be doing that or at least showing me how. But I'm curious, you know, we do hear occasionally, more than once a year, we hear about broadcasters who are hit by ransomware. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if, you know, without naming any names, maybe you could give us some advice. A few years ago, back when people were still using Internet Explorer, and still the default way to get onto a Windows machine was as an administrator. Right. Some advice I heard a few years ago was, look, Do these two things and you eliminate 97% of the attack surface. Right. Don't run as administrator and don't use Internet Explorer. Now that was it may have been 5 years ago. Right. Do you have a few rules of thumb? Not that you're guaranteeing it'll keep people safe, but what are the minimum things that you ought to not be doing the default of?
The biggest risk, I think, is something that's called horizontal movement. Once someone gets inside your infrastructure on any business office machine or, you know, the machine in the corner of the studio that they surf the web on, they should not be able to move horizontally through your infrastructure with, you know, through credential sharing or inadequate isolation. You really do need to understand how to protect critical infrastructure and also to back it up as well. You need to be able to do rapid restores on things, but you really do need to look at your network as a whole and not have dumped everything into a single bucket where everything can get into everything else. That's a recipe for disaster, and that just is why entire enterprises get shut down, is lack of isolation between different areas of the business.
Okay. Understood that. At my own stations, I've been working to make sure we don't have any more shared drives. We actually end up using Dropbox quite a bit. I don't know if I'm fooling myself into a sense of safety here, but things just aren't connected to each other anymore. They're connected to outside resources on the internet.
Right. And that at least gives you, usually a lot of these outside file storage sites will give you some sort of version retention or backup history. That's another really big thing. Do you have everything from a week ago or from a month ago? You know, can you go back in time if you need to recover from something? But again, it's looking at the tools and practices of enterprise level IT, who has really figured out a lot of these risk structures and figuring out how we can apply it to the broadcast environment. Whereas you said, we used to just run everything as local administrator because it was easier. And, you know, we've learned, okay, it makes it a little harder not to do that, but we can't do that anymore. And you have to find a way to make software work. Some software really does fight you and try to force bad practices, and you can't give up on it. You've got to figure out a way to get things to run with least privileges.
Run with least privileges. That's good advice right there. If you built studios today, how do they look different than studios you built before? Do you still have a big U-shaped piece of furniture? You have a big honking audio console, big speakers hanging from the ceiling, or are things a little different?
Yes and no. Some of these things should go away. Some of these things should not go away. I look at studios that were built 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, and the amount of rack space that is in these studios is just absurd for today. I actually designed a set of studio furniture that had 104 RU of rack space in the studio because I needed it.
Yeah.
And again, things I'll never do again is that. You know, get as much gear out of the studios as you can. First off, make it not exist at all. Again, as we talked about doing things in software that you used to do in hardware, the way I look at it, all the things that really should be in a studio, maybe some monitor amps, some mic processors, or at least not even mic processors, mic preamps or nodes of some sort. Mm-hmm. And really not a whole lot else. If you can get mix engines out of the studio, why does all that stuff need to be in there? It lessens the visual bulk of the furniture and how much gear is sitting there getting hot and covered in dust and spilled drinks and so on. So the other thing that I'm looking at a lot is how we manage the mess of monitors that we end up with now in all of these studios. I haven't found great solutions yet, but there are a lot of KVM systems that let you do user level switching between machines. I've always thought that would be a really good way to do it. But we have to design these studios so that they're much more visually attractive. You talked about giant speakers hanging. You know, we can start putting that stuff up in clouds, up above the ceilings, to really get things out of the line of sight. And first off, a studio should be designed to have a clear line of sight for interviews. I see so many studios where, from the operator's position, there's a giant wall in front of them and they can't see across the countertop. That is not good just from a content production standpoint for them to talk to a guest that's sitting on the other side of the counter, much less for getting good video angles.
I'm seeing a lot of consoles or furniture built with a bit of a gap behind the audio console between you and the people at the other end, other side of you. And this gap is where cables typically run into, but also you can fit computer monitors down in there just a little bit so that from your normal sight line, you're just cutting off the bottom of the monitor, just almost. And so the monitors end up being, you know, down at chest level, not at eye level.
Right. They're down in a well. So that they're not entirely above the console surface. The other thing is use large wall mount displays for things that don't need to be right in front of people. If you've got a call screener display, you know, what's a 70-inch TV set cost these days? Nothing. Put it on the other side of the room, run HDMI into it out of the computer. And now you've gotten one more monitor out, you know, from in front of the operator.
I was just thinking. Yeah, a few minutes ago, you said, "Hey, we got a monitor problem." It's been 25 years ago when I worked at Scott Studios. Our monitor problem was that the freaking CRT with the touchscreen weighed 87 pounds. It was horrible.
I ordered an automation system once, and UPS had to send a dedicated truck towing a trailer to bring everything over there, mostly because of the giant 20-inch touchscreen CRT monitors that we had to put in all these studios. And again, things have just gotten so much smaller, cheaper, lighter, faster, quieter. Every broadcast automation computer used to be a 4RU rack mount machine.
Yeah.
I've been buying, you know, these little 1RU pizza box computers, even for workstations that I rack and KVM out. There's so many tools that are available that if you take a new look at things and go, how can I do this in the smallest footprint and with the least amount of hardware possible to accomplish the job, then your facility gets easier to manage.
You mentioned mic processors earlier. I typically install Axia consoles because they're my employer. I eat my own dog food, and they've all got mic processing built in, and it's pretty darn adequate. You know, it's based on some very tried and true design. So.
Absolutely. You know, there's software tools that will do that if you need something else. But I agree that, you know, for probably 90-95% of applications, the built-in processing in a console will get you where you need to be.
In the news, outside of New York City, we keep hearing about New York City and lockdowns and how it's tough to do this and tough to do that. I know that you made a comment earlier that there are permanent employees at Hot 97 and WBLS, permanent employees who you've never met.
That's
tell me about that experience.
Yeah. it's the reality of the modern working world. I mean, now that we've learned that we can work remote, we can also hire remote. You can draw across a big pool of talent around the country. We've had that situation a couple of times. Hey, so-and-so is going to be working for us. They're in X city. Ship them a laptop. And this is, again, where our IT environment has had to get better. We have to be able to fully manage computers that we can't get to, including whatever we would need to do as an administrator, elevating privileges, et cetera, without going and making a house call to that employee's house that would be a plane flight away otherwise. And we have to be good enough in terms of building a computer that we can ship it out to someone and it'll be ready for them to use when it gets to their house without us having to be there and walk them through the initial setup.
Ah, okay. Okay.
So it really does have kind of an effect on how we do these things because, you know, if someone's start day is on X day and you ship them a computer and it doesn't work, they can't do anything.
They can't start. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So again, where we've had to adjust our practices, we used to have, you know, we'd be at the user's desk at 9 a.m. when they were here in the office to show them how to log in, how to print, how to do all of these things. We have not been able to do that for 2 years now. So,
talk to me for a minute about, maybe for a while here about transmitter sites. Where are your transmitters?
In terms of physical location.
Yeah.
So we're up on the Empire State Building as our primary and on Four Times Square as our aux site. I have I completely rebuilt the Empire site a number of years ago. The Four Times Square site was a new build. We moved up from another AUX site a few years ago. You know, we tried again to build these sites as standardized, as clean as we possibly could, as manageable as we possibly could. But even then, where I say I wouldn't do things the same way again, I look at transmitter sites in general, and this is, some people have seen my rant about this on Facebook every now and then. I don't like the way we as a radio industry do transmitter sites. I think we have way too much stuff at them. Yeah, if you look at a TV transmitter site, for example, they send a fully multiplexed ASI stream up there that runs into the transmitter as IP, and that's that.
Okay.
You know, they'll have their ENG gear and some monitoring gear there, but they don't have two racks of switching and processing and so on at a lot of these sites. It's not necessary because they can send a signal up to the transmitter that's 100% ready for air. Whereas we still kind of have a lot of boxes, again, a lot of separate boxes in the chain. You have multiple different types of STLs. You have to switch between those types of STLs. You have, you know, main and auxiliary processors. You may have HD time alignment devices. You have importers, you have exporters, you have PPM devices, you have Voltaire devices, all of the composite switchers, all of these things just add up. Then you tie all of this into remote controls. I thought I was getting fancy when I stopped using, you know, hard contact closures and started using SNMP to control some of these switchers where I could, but it's still just so much stuff, and it consumes rack space. It can go, it can have a problem if you're not there. And it's just, I start to question, is there a better way? And this is really something that I pushed a lot of manufacturers towards, is draw out an air chain of a modern radio station and start finding ways to make it happen with fewer devices or consolidating functions from one device into another. You know, again, embedding PPM encoding functionality as software in various other devices. One of the other things that I've looked at is I wouldn't really be doing discrete audio switchers anymore. Now I feel comfortable enough with audio over IP to be doing, if even if I have non-AOIP sources, to be matrixing and switching all of that in AOIP at a transmission.
Right.
That's another thing. I wouldn't do it that way again, where I wouldn't put in all these discrete audio switchers. I'd put everything into an AOIP network that lives at the transmitter itself. Again, just by having fielded AOIP for long enough, to me, I'm comfortable with having it at a remote location that I can't get to as quickly. So
that's interesting. I totally agree. I'm a little fuzzy on how you handle all the HD stuff, and maybe you want to advise me on that a bit. Right. But now at my stations, we don't have HD at any of them. We're going to put it at one just so we can feed a translator. Right. But years, literally 6-7 years ago, I put an IP link that would handle live wire, and I put an X node at the transmitter site. It was purely an economic decision. It would have cost us $40,000 to do individual 950 megahertz STLs. Mm-hmm. And it cost us $5,000-$6,000 to do it with some cheap radios and a node. And now I can change the subscription. I can do my switching at the transmitter site by remote control on that X node. Now, the world of HD seems more complicated to me. How does that work?
And again, it's a question of looking at the boxes and going, first off, why are they boxes on their own? And secondly, why are they here? So HD, you're sending the E to X packetized signal to the from the exporter to the exciter. And then you're also sending the analog FM composite signal plus RDS and any subcarriers you may have. Mm-hmm. And there are now products on the market that will do a better job of remoting those out. We tried doing that at the very beginning of HD, of having the importers at the studios. And we always had massive time delay slippage, and there's still some reports of that, even with the Justins and the other automatic time alignment devices. What we really honestly need is to keep the packetized E to X signal in time with the composite audio signal. And I haven't tested this yet, but I've been told that the Gates Air codec that embeds an IP stream in its primary stream, which can also include the composite over AES 192 or the digitized composite, will keep that time alignment. That's one of the things I'd love to try and see if that eliminates any drift or glitching and truly lets us get all that hardware back to the studios. And then I start asking the question about, you know, importers, the importers that are on the market. Everything should be taking AOIP inputs because that's what we have. You know, and again, starting to merge these devices down. An importer is a Windows computer, an exporter is, you know, principally runs on an embedded Linux, I think. Starting to look at ways to consolidate all of this gear into single boxes, and then to get it back to the studios where we can actually work on it. Because as you said, we have these great high bandwidth, cheap IP links now. It really is not a big deal to put up a 5.8 gigahertz or licensed 11, 18, or 23 gig shot. If you really want, you can have hundreds of megabits of data back and forth to your transmitter on licensed spectrum without a lot of work.
Yeah. Yep. So. Talk to me for just a minute before we have to take our last break. Talk to me about loudness standards and how they apply to your streaming or your HD or your FM. I doubt they really apply to your main FM signal. We all try to be loud and proud. Where do loudness standards like minus 16 LUFS or LKFS and so forth, where does that come into play in a plant like yours?
Short answer is it's going to. That's on one of the things that I really want to do as operational improvements is train the videography and audio production staff on the industry standards for content that's not just going to run on our own channels, but may go somewhere else, because we should be submitting standards compliant content. Next question is, do we need to close caption some of this content? There are rules that may go into place if our content goes and gets distributed somewhere else. So again, are there tools that can automate this for us? Are there workflow management tools that can do transcriptions, that can do loudness control? I think that a lot of us have just kind of done this the way that web video has been produced, which is just to produce it, edit it, and publish it. But there is another level of it that we really can go to. And I do think that that's another thing we need to look at.
Wow. Wow. Hybrid radio, is that a thing yet? Is it going to be a thing where you go out of your service area for 97.1, but people can still, their radio switch to the stream automatically? Is that coming up?
I can't comment on it for my organization. Ah. It's an interesting technology. So gotcha. I'm looking at it and curious about it. So,
well, yes, us too. We're doing the streaming thing, but, never know how well that's, well, I tell you what, with our radio stations in American Samoa, when there's a big football game going on, in Pongo Pongo, we got a lot of West Coast. Listen, we exceed our stream with that.
Right.
People want to hear that. Right. We're going to have to take our last break here. When we come back, I didn't tell you about this, but it's the usual tip of the week thing. You're going to have an opportunity, Alex, to leave us with a bit of knowledge, things we might walk away with, and you know, something that's helped you, maybe help somebody else. So Alex Roman is our guest here on This Week in Radio Tech. He is the Chief Technical Officer at Media Co. New York Radio, and he's also the mayor, the elected mayor, elected by the populace in Verona, New Jersey. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends over at Broadcast Bionics and their Camera One product, which, you know, is something that Alex could use. I mean, if you're producing video for your channel, whether it's live video for the whole show or whether it's just snippets of the highlights of your show for social media, check this out from Broadcast Bionics.
Camera One from Broadcast Bionics. Designed to bring video to your audio content. Visualizing radio and podcasts for social media. Camera One can automatically create, capture, and brand professionally switched video for live streaming or upload, making your production shareable. Control and configure using a web browser on any device. Camera One is available as a 4-camera or 8-camera system using the Blackmagic A10 Mini range, including the A10 Mini Extreme. You can use cameras to suit your studio and your budget. You'll need one camera for a studio wide shot and usually one camera per microphone. A standard multi-channel sound card or IP driver monitors audio from each studio microphone, and we work natively with Axia systems. Ideally, this will be a post-fader feed from each mic, although you can use pre-fade audio or a mic split if that's all you have available. These audio levels are used to intelligently switch the video feed when each contributor is talking. You can also group microphones together into one shot and use the audio from a mixer's aux bus. You can use Camera One's auto switch feature, or disable it and switch using the on-screen buttons or the buttons on the A10. Recordings can automatically start when you tell the system you're on the air. This on-air indication can be linked to your studio's red lights via IP or an Avantech Atom GPIO interface. You can quickly browse all the videos that have been automatically created during your broadcast, download them, and post. Camera One is a user-installable system. You'll need a good spec Windows 10 PC, i7 with plenty of storage, and 16 gig of RAM. It's better if this machine isn't used for anything else. Remember, you can control the software in a web browser on another device on your network. Camera One, a thrifty way of creating scroll-stopping video from your show or podcast from Broadcast Bionics.
Love Broadcast Bionics and Camera One. Thank you for sponsoring the show. And if you've got any interest at all, it's bionic.radio. Bionic.radio is the web address to get you right there to Broadcast Bionics. Good stuff. Alex, we got a couple more minutes than I thought. I wanted to mention somebody asked me to make sure we mentioned the MS Tiki Room, or at least the Tiki Room. what's that about?
Secrets again that I can't give away.
Okay.
We'll just say that it's a time-honored NAB tradition amongst those of us that have worked for MS at some time or another. So.
Good deal. All right. And let's see. Oh, I was asked to ask you about, let's see, Tim Braddock asked you about something. What the heck was it? Gosh, I'll remember it in just a second here. It was on my phone. I'm so embarrassed here. Let me see if I can find that real quick. Here we go. Tim just said something about former boss. You're his or he's yours?
I'm sorry. Tim used to work he was a longtime engineer for BLS, used to work for me here. So
that's gotcha.
Yeah.
So. Gotcha. Good deal. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, talk to me about a tip of the week. What pontification would you like to leave for folks to think about?
This is an incredibly simple one, but the post that I got the single most likes for posting a photo on Facebook and also started the most arguments about, you know, when you model out a power strip in a studio and it's got screw holes on the back of it and you can't figure out the sizes of things.
Yeah.
Take the power strip, put it on top of the office copier and make a copy of it. Now you got a template. You can do this.
That's great. Oh my gosh. Cause I'm always, you know, putting it up and turning it and trying to align a screw and put one screw in. Okay. Where would that? And then I always get it's always off by an eighth of an inch, you know, or 3/16. Yeah. And I end up jamming one screw in and jamming it the other way. And then bam, jamming it.
And you just take the template, you tape it up where you want it. You run the screws through the holes on the template and you mount the power strip. Now this started a big fight of people saying that you're going to damage the copier.
What?
Yeah, they, you know, okay, maybe not a metal power strip. And then the other thing that we got into an argument about was the sizing ratio of the copier that apparently they printed about 96% of the scanned image size and whether that's precise enough for the screw holes on the bottom of a power strip or not. But that was a good one. And we, you know, every single time I've shown someone that tip, they just go, my entire career, I've been fighting with this, you know, and you can do it for anything, wireless access points, things you want to hang on the wall, anything that's got to hang on a set of screws, go make a copy of it.
How hard would it be to make power strips with a plastic tunnel from the front to the back and just use a long screw?
Right. Well, the ones that I try and buy are the ones that have tabs on the ends of them where the screw holes are through them. So you just run them through from the outside. Those are usually the metal ones that are a little better anyway.
Yeah.
But you know, no matter what, we've all got a giant bin full of, you know, $6, plastic power strips that we use for this, that, and the other thing. And you never have one of the ones you want when you need it. So they're everywhere. I'm not going to deny reality that those need to be used for things. So.
All right. I'll ask you for another tip. If anyone in our audience decides that they're going to run for mayor of their town, what advice would you have for someone running for mayor, either in the process of running or, okay, you're mayor now. Well, what's important that they do first?
So the one thing that we always said from running in our town is there's two things that you figure out is one, that there are as many dogs as people, because when you ring every doorbell, the dogs run to the door, and there's not a single street in our town that's flat. So when your parents used to say they went uphill to school both ways, they really meant it. So get a good pair of walking shoes. You know, honestly, just do it is what I tell. If you feel like you have something to offer.
Yeah.
A lot of smaller towns in particular struggle for people even to volunteer on things like land use boards or open space committees or recreation committees, other things where they just need people to put a voice in. And you just need a couple hours a month in the evening and you can actually direct the way things go in your community. And we frequently struggle to find people to fill those spots. So volunteer. If you care about where you live, try and find some way that you can volunteer and make it a better place.
That's great advice. Make it a better place. I may change the show title to that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Alex Roman has been our guest for the last hour on This Week in Radio Tech. Alex, it's been a pleasure to have you on. I hope you'll come back again sometime.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad we got to do this.
All right. Take care. Alex Roman, the chief technical officer at MediaCo, New York City Radio, and also the mayor, the elected mayor, elected by the constituents there in Verona, New Jersey. All right. Our show has been brought to you by the usual suspects. You know who they are. Let's see. Put me back on there. Angry. I'm a terrible producer. Angry Audio, Max Connect Wireless, Inovonics, and Broadcast Bionics. Say thank you to them, would you? Buy their stuff. at least check out their websites and let them know that you heard about them here on This Week in Radio Tech. Next week, we've got a couple more good shows before the end of the year. And a friend of mine named Sam Wu, who was a friend of Chris Tobin, is going to be on an upcoming show. So check that out in just a couple of weeks. Hope you have a great holiday season, a beautiful Christmas, happy Hanukkah, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.